Hello and welcome to the Data Journalism Podcast. My name is Simon Rogers. I'm a data journalist, speaker and teacher and data editor at Google.
And my name is Alberto Cairo. I am a professor of visualization at the University of Miami, an infographics designer and journalist, and also a book author.
We love using data to tell stories, and the music you can hear is a sound of data made with two-tone, an app that turns numbers into tunes. It's also the sound of football, American football that is, with a changing football score since 1920, care of one of our guests today.
And this is the Data Journalism Podcast that dissects the latest trends in data journalism around the world. In each episode, we will explore the latest in data journalism, and we will chat with some of the world's top data journalists. You'll get to find out how they do what they do.
So, subscribe at datajournalismpodcast.com to see how data is changing the world of journalism forever.
Hi, Simon.
Hey, Alberto.
How are you doing?
So good. I'm really thrilled to have the chat that we had this week. It was a lot of fun.
It was a very interesting one, right? Can you tell us a little bit about our guests?
Yeah, so we have two doyen of local data journalism. We've got Ben Welsh from the LA Times, who has been just one of the first people out there to really see the power of using data to tell stories. The Los Angeles Times had one of the first great data journalism sections, and he has forgotten more than we will ever learn about how data can just improve local reporting. And we also are lucky enough to have Mary Jo Webster, who is a great local reporter who's just taught herself how to work in this area and really created some interesting work.
It was a very interesting conversation with both of them, and we got into sort of how they got started, how they discovered the tools that they use nowadays, beginning with Excel. they tell a couple of funny stories about how they discovered Excel and then later more sophisticated data analysis tools. I think that it was a very enlightening conversation and listeners will enjoy it a lot.
We should do an episode one day about Excel and the power of this tool in getting people into data journalism. Love it or hate it, it's just become this kind of like entry-level drug for people who are getting into data and reporting.
And it's super useful. You can do amazing things with Excel, right? I mean, both Ben and Mary Jo, they mention R, the programming language, and Python and many other tools. But both of them say, you know, if you can get away with doing this very simple thing with Excel, why don't do it with Excel? Or, you know, if you're getting started in this field, it's better to begin with the tools that you already know. And many people already know how to use Excel, right?
Yeah, and one of the things we want to do with this episode is really get into some of the nitty-gritty. So we have a rapid-fire series of questions at the end, really about the kind of people's top tools, some of their foibles, some of the stories they care about. It's a lot of fun, and I would really advise sticking around to that because you'll learn a lot about how each of them works.
It was an excellent episode, I think. So let's get into it.
Let's get into it.
Hi, I'm Mary Jo Webster. I'm the data editor at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis.
And hello, I'm Ben Welsh. I live in Los Angeles, where I work on a project at Stanford University called Big Local News and at the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you so much for joining us, Mary Jo and Ben. We're really happy to have you both here today to talk really about local data journalism and how it's growing around the country, and I think around the world as well. But I would love you to talk a little bit first about how you got into this. Well, now, Ben, when I was at The Guardian back in the day, when we were setting up the data blog, we're definitely looking at the work that you guys were doing. And I feel like you were actually really one of the innovators in this field. So talk to me a little bit about how you got into data journalism and the kind of work that you do.
Well, it definitely wasn't the plan. It wasn't anything that happened on purpose, but I'm really glad it did. I was a pretty listless undergraduate in Chicago, Illinois, and at DePaul University, and kind of unclear of where I was going with my life and career, like perhaps many undergraduates that Alberto encounters from time to time, and maybe himself as well. And I won't bore you with the whole long story, but through sort of an unusual series of events, I became the assistant to two local television journalists in Chicago who were both excellent practitioners. And I became what was known at that time as the footman, which was a very glorified term for the intern or the helper around the office. And so as they prepared a weekly newspaper column and television piece, I would do research and scheduling and a little bit of television editing too. And in that, I kind of caught the journalism bug. And one of the early stories we worked on was about corruption in a Chicago suburb. Locals could probably guess which ones. And we did my first public records request for legal fees from a sort of local heavy who was milking the city out of money. And it came as a really, really long printout. Like the one, you remember when printouts used to have the perforated tears along each side and a single print over 20, 30 pages would be connected through these long strips in the side that you'd have to rip off, right? And we got that back, this epic printout of all the legal fees. And we thought, well, what are we going to do with this? How are we going to turn this into a story? And I don't even know from where, but I got the idea of just typing it into a spreadsheet. I think it was probably the first spreadsheet of my entire life. And I spent, you know, having nothing better to do, I spent a good chunk of time just hammering all that in, and we added it up. And at the end, you know, that number got read out on the local news. The anchor even climbed up a stepladder and dropped the sort of accordion of paper live on camera, which was kind of a funny little gag. And I kind of caught the bug. You know what I mean? I saw that, you know, through technology and data was kind of like a way I could help. It's something I could chip in and do. You know, it was a place for me to contribute. And it also was a gateway to doing more ambitious journalism than just the average run-of-the-mill story. You know, we did a story nobody else was doing that was more ambitious and analytical, and that was exciting. And so I kind of just got into it there. This is now 20 years ago, I guess, or more than that, actually. And I just followed that. And without boring you with my whole life story, I mean, I kind of ended up on this podcast today.
And Mary Jo, tell us about how you caught the bug.
Mine is very much a local news-based situation. I was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years into my career working as a reporter in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, a very small daily paper. I was tasked with covering the police and sheriff's department, both on a kind of a policy standpoint, but also, you know, I went out to the crime scenes and the fires and whatnot. But I was covering the city budget, and it looked like the police department was growing its budget dramatically one year to the next. And I was sitting there with a calculator trying to calculate the percent change between the 2 years for all of the departments. And a colleague of mine came over and said, "Do you know what Excel is?" And I was like, "No, no idea." He opened it up. He showed me how to do a simple percent change formula. My eyes were bugging out. I was like, "Wow, this is so cool. Where did you learn this?" You see, he told me I went to this IRE and NICAR boot camp, and they teach you all this stuff called, back then it was called computer assisted reporting. And I was immediately hooked, and I decided I had to keep going. And sometime later that year, I was able to attend a training that Sarah Cohen did. She was the IRE trainer at the time. And I remember sitting in this room, I don't think it was a hands-on training, my memory serves, but I just remember being enthralled by everything she was saying and mind being blown by this entirely different way of reporting that I had not learned in college, that my editors had not taught me in my early years. And it was a complete turning point for me.
That's amazing. Both the story. Well, welcome to the podcast in the first place. So thank you for being here. But the stories that you are telling are similar to some of the stories that I tell my students, that when you see data journalism or my own field, data visualization from the outside, it looks like these very shiny, super advanced, high technology kind of endeavor. But when you see how the sausage is made, it's actually sometimes pretty pedestrian, right? It's like you essentially type the data into an Excel spreadsheet, or you don't use, you know, machine learning algorithm. No, you just use a simple Excel pivot table, right? So I find all that absolutely fascinating. I mean, we are going to go back and forth between your professional careers, but also other sides of your professional endeavors. I'm really curious about your educational endeavors, because both of you have been involved in educational initiatives, right? Can you talk a little bit about that, both of you?
You mean our what training we have taken or the teaching?
The training that you offer, because, for example, Mary Jo, you have a Data Journalism Academy, right? So both of you have been involved in these types of initiatives. Not only, I mean, you didn't take advantage of things such as like IRE NICAR, but you also offer to the community.
Yes, I'm a huge believer in teaching. I think it has helped me as much as it helps the other people, because I believe very much in the learn, do, teach approach. I found all the holes in my knowledge by having to turn around and teach it to somebody else. So I've also gotten so much back from other people. That's how I learned. So I feel the need to turn around and teach it to other people. I taught for about 10 years as an adjunct at the University of Minnesota, a data journalism class that was, you know, fully dedicated just to data journalism. I'm currently a senior fellow with the Center for Health Journalism's data journalism program, and that we do a week-long training, and then we do 6 months of mentoring and additional training throughout that time. And I'm particularly enjoying the mentoring part of that, because it's another level of teaching. You're helping them get a project off the ground. You didn't just teach them how to run things in Excel and then walk away. You keep it going and help them get a story out the door, and it's quite fulfilling, actually. And then I've taught at IRE and NICAR a lot, and I built up so many materials that I've gradually decided I should share those materials. And at the start of the pandemic, when I had a bunch of free time, I thought, you know what, it's time to turn some of these materials into videos. And so I made a new website and posted a lot of stuff there, mainly Excel and R and other teaching things. I am doing a new thing right now that I'm actually going to present about this at the NICAR conference this year. I've created a little data for editors training module for the assignment editors in our room. And so these are the people who work directly with the reporters, mainly in our local news section. And I've broken it down. I'm not teaching them how to use Excel or how to run data or any of that. I've broken it down into little sections of the different points in a data-driven story that the editor needs to weigh in and look at, and where they should be, what they should be doing at each point and what they should be looking for. So like the key ones are that brainstorming process with their reporters when they're talking about what story should I do? What should I tackle? I'm giving them some clues that they should be watching for, that maybe there's a data opportunity here, what questions they should be asking, things like that. And then the bulletproofing process. Okay, the data has come in. We've got findings. We're showing you a bunch of charts and tables. What do you do with it? Too often the editors just look at it and go, oh, that's pretty. Oh, that's kind of interesting. And I'm trying to teach them, like, how about we take it to another level and you really help bulletproof it. And then the third level is the editing the written story. One of the things I've seen a lot is editors see a paragraph full of numbers and they just glaze right over it. And they don't think about, like, what are we really saying? What are the key points we're getting across? So I'm trying to teach them some editing things around, you know, what's the key finding? You know, not lumping too many numbers in a paragraph, all these kinds of things to try to help make the story more powerful. And then we're also going to do a graphic session. My colleague, the head of our graphics department, is going to help me with that. And that'll be more about, okay, when should we use graphics? What kinds of graphics should we use? What should you as an editor be doing when we send you those proofs? Instead of just saying, oh, that looks beautiful, what else should you be doing? And I'm really anxious to see what kind of outcome that gets. If it leads to more data-driven stories on a beat basis and more daily basis or weekly basis, not just the big enterprise kind of stories.
What about you, Ben? Can you talk a little bit about your educational efforts?
Well, I think Mary Jo said something very sort of succinct and wise there with the learn, do, teach formulation. You know what I mean? It's a great way. It definitely benefits yourself. But I also think there's another great thing about that kind of approach or model is there's really a very sort of like stimulating and actually rewarding creative process of converting something that you've learned how to do into like a lesson or something that you can teach someone else. And it actually is like, it kind of gets the neurons firing the same way when you're like kind of innovating the code in the first place for the idea. And so for me, along those lines, you know, one like sort of approach to teaching that I've enjoyed or found fruitful is taking emerging new techniques that we're developing in the newsroom that I feel like are kind of like a big deal for me or a big deal for our team, but that I don't see like being taught, and then trying to convert that into like a NICAR bootcamp or class to try to spread it to other people. And so, you know, examples, I've done this with not alone. I always try to seek out other folks to help me like really strengthen the idea. But with others, we've created some of the earliest NICAR bootcamps on how to use Jupyter Notebooks, how to use the static site frameworks that so many newsrooms use to make standalone visual stories, but like nobody ever talks about, right? And this year at NICAR, we're going to have, I think, the first kind of 3-hour bootcamp on how to automate a scraper within the GitHub Actions framework. And so to me, like those three things, Jupyter Notebooks, static site page building, Git scraping, are three really important like technologies that have taken off in our world in the last 5 or 10 years. And it's just been fun to try to like think about and pin down, well, how exactly do we use these? What are the fundamental skills? How can I pass that on to someone else?
It's really interesting to me how you're both so involved in teaching. And I wonder, if does that reflect at all? And I wonder if this is particularly applies to people working with data journalism at a local level, is that often people are kind of isolated. Often it's like one or two people on their own. They've got no support. There's no network. But the colleagues on other organizations are kind of struggling in the same way. So there's a kind of a need there. Is that fair?
I love the psychoanalytical take here. I mean, I did grow up as a lonely, nerdy kid on a gravel road, Simon, you know what I mean, who didn't have a lot of friends. And so maybe this is me still trying to connect, you know what I mean, and get over. I wish, not crazy.
Well, I think you're right. There's so many that, you know, these days they refer to themselves as lonely coders. The majority of my 20 years in data journalism was spent in a newsroom where I didn't have support from anybody else. And so I sought it out from other people and learned from other people. And then, you know, I turned around and taught. But I think another factor is the NICAR community has always been a sharing community. If you even look at how NICAR was formed in the first place, it was really a group of investigative reporters who realized they needed to learn how to work with data, and they didn't know. And a few of them learned somehow, I'm not sure how, and then they decided to share it with the others to try to pass it along. And so it was really, that's how NICAR got started. And that has been infused in, throughout all the years. I remember so many boot camps, and I think Ben is guilty of this, of people sitting at the bar at the end of the conference, helping somebody with their data, with a, you know, hovering over a laptop, helping someone with their data when they should be, you know, having fun and enjoying themselves. But that's how much I think our community likes to share and teach each other. And it just, it's wonderful.
Yeah. And just to add to that, I mean, I think if you follow the origins back, like Mary Jo was doing, I mean, data journalism's roots go a lot further than I think is commonly recognized. You know what I mean? It's really a practice that stretches back decades into the invention of the computer in the 60s and 70s. And I think is that culture of those early days is probably in like an anthropological sense, like indistinguishable from the hacker culture of MIT that's so celebrated. You know what I mean? It really was a very similar people with very similar sort of ethos of sharing that is the wellspring for a lot of what we do today. And I think that, you know, as an inheritor of that, you know, I continue to be inspired by it, and I feel some obligation to uphold it, you know?
I think that we all do. We all have the sort of like feel the need to contribute back to the community that helped us at the beginning of our career, right? I have a question related to what you were both saying about, you know, growing up as a nerdy kid, right? I sort of sympathize with that because, I mean, people don't see where I'm sitting right now, but I'm sitting in a room with my kid and then surrounded by comic books, science fiction novels, you know, books about history and psychology, and then some tabletop games. So the nerdery comes naturally to me. So has that improved or has that changed? It's like, are we still seen or are you still seen as sort of like the nerds in the newsroom? Or has that situation changed and data journalism, data visualization, computer assisted reporting, has become more widespread and more accepted or more popular within local newsrooms? What do you think?
I think it is more widely accepted as a tool that every reporter should have in their toolbox. I like to talk about data analysis as really another form of interviewing a source. That's all we're doing, really. And it just requires kind of a little bit of a foreign language to do it. I also see data journalists increasingly as the innovators in the room. In all the newsrooms I've been in for quite a few years now, the data journalists have been at the forefront of whatever new digital innovation we're going to do. And they're the ones pushing for it and seeking it out. And in my newsroom right now, my team is the one often called upon for, like, what do we do next? Where do we go? And I think that's wonderful. And I think that takes us out of the nerdy idea into kind of more of the leaders.
Yeah, and you see this in the product realm too, where a lot of people out of the data journalism world have become leaders in the next generation of digital business products their companies are putting together, which is, you know, a whole another level beyond just like what's happening in the newsroom. To be frank with you, I think in the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a quantum leap with data journalism in newsrooms. The takeover has happened. You see it at the prestige level with those metrics. You look at the Pulitzer Prizes last year, 5 of the Pulitzer Prizes went to data journalism projects, including the public service highest award, which went to the New York Times COVID tracking effort, right? Which on its own was a gigantic public service and an incredible feat of like data gathering and analysis. But it also was the most popular, and I'll say it, most lucrative thing the New York Times has ever published. And those COVID tracking things, I bet at the Minneapolis paper was the most popular thing ever published. I'll just throw that out there. Mary Jo can correct me. It's the most popular thing the Washington Post ever published. It's the most popular thing the Los Angeles Times published. You know, and I don't mean to demean the news by saying that, but once the product you're creating is both the high prestige thing and more importantly, the economic engine, you know what I mean, that's growing the digital audience, of which there's a desperate need to grow, the entire way the organization looks at you changes, just fundamentally. And that's happened.
Yes, it the tracker we'd put up is hands down the historically most read page in the history of the Star Tribune. And the numbers on it are so astronomical that I don't envision it being that record being broken. It would take something pretty massive, I think, to break it. But the other interesting thing we saw is that it was also the most popular page among our digital readers who are not subscribers, but they come to us pretty regularly and we would like them to be subscribers. We call them intenders. And it was the most popular page among them. And you know, now we have conversations going around what else like that, maybe not data, but more in the service journalism realm, but data is one of the things you can do for service journalism. What can we do to help get more of those people to become subscribers?
Exactly. This all changed. And Steve Kornacki was named one of the sexiest men alive, guys. Come on. We're on top.
Yeah, the dog agrees with that assessment. So we have talked a lot about COVID on this podcast. And I wonder what you think the longer term effects are going to be for your field of that very data intensive experience of working with COVID data in a way that, you know, readers and users actually really responded to.
I mean, the tracker thing is here to stay. And I think, you know, the creating dashboards for the general public on major topics they care about is not new. I mean, it's something that's been around with weather, you know, and sports for a long time. But I think that it's a type of product that clearly our audience wants that is, in my opinion, like capital J journalism in most circumstances, but requires like a new assembly line to be constructed inside the metaphorical factory of your newsroom to create that. You know what I mean? It requires a little bit more of a product development mindset, a longer development cycle, a more iterative approach, you know what I mean, than juggling what's on Sunday's front page and the sort of like day-to-day heartbeat of the newsroom. And so I think there's a way in which to produce more of those kinds of widgets, data journalism teams are going to have to find a way to create a kind of app workflow that's able to support that. And I think that's becoming more like a product development team in some ways.
from a different perspective, I think it's going to have a long-term effect in newsrooms, because I think it really woke up a lot of people to the need and benefits to being able to analyze your own data and not rely on a government official to hand you some numbers on a press release, especially in those early days where, you know, we kind of had to pull stuff together ourselves. But then even more long-term is data literacy, increasing understanding among reporters and editors for the need to understand all the weird little caveats behind data and the problems we have with denominators and whatnot. And I think that's there's going to be, I'm expecting to see greater appetite for data training in my newsroom.
We talked a lot about how data journalism is affecting, you know, the bottom line for news organizations and how they're all seeing the value now. If you're a reader or a user, and you don't necessarily realize you're looking at data journalism, I guess, but you know, what difference does it make to them? Do you think it helps people understand their local areas better in ways that we haven't quite kind of grasped the long-term impact of yet?
Well, I think the way we present data journalism, especially in, you know, charts and graphs and things like that, allow people who maybe need a visual aid like that to see something rather than reading long sentences of text, that some readers just do better with that, absorbing information that way than others. And I think also the readers maybe who aren't naturally inclined to do that are getting better at it because there is so much of it.
Sorry, Ben, were you going to say something? We can make a pause. Let's edit this out. Okay, perfect. I was about to say, let's begin there. We all have projects in our past as professionals that we are very fond of, even if they are not perhaps the best projects that we have ever done, but there are certain projects that we hold dear, right? So if you had to choose just one of your local data journalism projects in the past, right, what would that be and why? What was the story about? What do you do to gather the data or visualize or display the data, explain the data, and what type of impact that story had?
In 2018, we did a series called Denied Justice that looked at how the criminal justice system in Minnesota was handling sex assault investigations. A reporter came to me and said he was hearing that that very few cases that get reported to police actually result in a conviction, but nobody tracks that. It's not a number that someone calculates. So we put in requests for thousands of police investigative reports and built our own database, tracking key bits of information off these cases and then hunting down, was this referred to the prosecutor? Were charges filed? Was somebody convicted? A mountain of work in order to get a few numbers. And what we found is like 8% of reported cases result in a conviction. And we ended up doing a series. It ended up being a 9-part series, which we did not expect, because it ended up being so powerful. The response was overwhelming from readers and policymakers. And we had hundreds of victims come forward to share their stories, because they read our first story and were like, oh my gosh, I'm not the only one who had this bad experience with the police department. I'm not the only one. This is so cathartic to hear this. And they wanted to share their stories. And as a result, Minnesota's sexual assault laws have been overhauled quite substantially. Several police departments have added additional staff or victim advocates embedded into their department, prosecutors embedded into the department to help improve the quality of the investigations. And it was one of the most, probably hands down the most rewarding piece of work I've ever done. At the end of it, we had we gathered all these victims at the state capitol and took a picture of all of them together. And these women came out in the bitter cold in Minnesota in December to do this photo. And they came up to me and the other reporters and they were so thankful. And I've never had that experience before, the people just thanking us for the work. And that story is a really big combination of data being the spine holding up the key findings, and then these powerful emotional stories from victims. And policymakers told us that the two things combined were so powerful that they could not ignore it.
Yeah, when the data comes together with real life in a way, you know what I mean? Or when the data leads you to the doorstep you didn't know you needed to go to, right? That is just this sort of like unforgettable feeling. You know what I mean? It's kind of like one of the deeper work hits of, it's better than any hack. You know what I mean? And so like for me, like an example of that was we had a circumstance where there was like a little political fight in LA government over the fire department that was really pretty superficial and was just couple people trying to score political points, but it raised some questions about the efficacy of the 911 system in the city of Los Angeles. And so my colleague and I, Robert Lopez, decided to get a copy of the entire 911 calls database and analyze what was happening with the 911 system. And, you know, there's a lot of ins and outs to how it all worked out. But the reality was, is by doing our own independent analysis of the data, we were able to identify several structural flaws in how the 911 center operates, how they handle calls near the city border with neighboring fire departments, and then go out into the real world, tracking real calls, knock on doors and find out what happened. And in that, we discovered these kind of deeper problems with the system that nobody was talking about in city politics. And we were able to really point to where the system needed to improve to like make a difference. And then change actually did happen, you know, and to me, that sort of like, that feeling of where the statistics lead you to the story, you listen to the numbers and then you follow them out into the real world. And then you connect that with what's really happening there. And then you bring that back to your audience. That's better than any chart. That's better. You know, I love charts, you know what I mean? But like, that's better than any little dinky thing. That's the deeper like thing that numbers and statistics can lead you to, which is the sort of hidden truth or the deeper story that isn't being told. And that's the hit, you know, I'm still looking for it on every story to get back to. I'm still chasing.
Those are both examples of stories where a human is probably not going to come forward and tell us that there's a story there. Maybe they'd have an inkling, but probably nobody did the data analysis to know for sure that that's what it is. And it you know, it takes us to do these kind of lifts, to heavy lifts on data to find those stories. And, you know, as I said, interview the source to get at the meat of that story that needs to be told.
And then sometimes, and I think this may have happened in Mary Jo's case too, your finding, your synthesis of what's really going on actually gives a name to and some meaning to something really negative that happened to somebody. And then they yes. find, then your sources and the people you're writing about find this deeper reward in the whole thing. And it's very rare, you know what I mean? But that, to me, that's as good as it gets.
That combination of like traditional reporting with the data and that sweet spot, then had to have impact as well, is just everything you can ask for, isn't it? So we are in February. This is our first pod of the year. If you two were to make predictions, I know everybody loves to make predictions, right? You two make predictions about what your big exercises are going to be this year.
Let's let Mary Jo off the hook here. We can't make her cough up too much. So since I'm working on this new project at Stanford called Big Local News, which is really an open source collaborative effort to try to be a data backbone for all the local newsrooms who, you know, maybe need help or some consulting or some technology to really pull off big data projects, we're looking to take it up a notch, Simon. I mean, I think this year, this team I'm on with Cheryl and Sirdar and everybody up on the farm in Palo Alto, I'll say it here, we are going to build the biggest web scrapers in the history of data journalism. We have a project called Agenda Watch, where we're going to scrape hundreds of city council agendas across the country, put them into one database. And we're going to try to do the same thing with county courthouses. And, you know, those types of projects, scraping your local county courthouse or city council. I mean, every local newspaper in America has wanted to do it. Some of them have tried to do it. A very few have succeeded in doing it for like a short period of time. But I just don't think that there's been a lasting and sort of broad solution to that challenge, because it's a lot of work. There's competing priorities. And we're really looking to solve that or try to by being the sort of database library that attacks those big, big things. And so by December 31st, we'll be the biggest scraper you've ever seen, outside of Google, of course.
I love Big Local News Project. I'm really glad to hear that. Okay, so we are going to finish off with a new section, which I'm going to just call No Dumb Questions, because these are quite dumb questions. And they're one-word answers, but I'm going to go first. And my one to Mary Jo is, what book or class had an impact on you as a professional?
The Investigative Reporter's Handbook.
Very good. How about you, Ben?
Oh, just one?
Yeah, just one, I'm afraid. Sorry.
Oh, man.
Be concise. We are all journalists. We are supposed
to be concise. All right, I'm gonna do it. I will say the one that had an effect on me. I will say the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alex Haley, guys. How about that? As like a young teenage me, you know what I mean, moving from the country to Chicago, getting a broader view of the world. It was nonfiction journalism that helped me like see what was up, you know, and this book is an alternative version of American history that I hadn't heard before. It's also a religious conversion story, not unlike one I'd been taught in church, you know, as a kid who went to Sunday school. And it shows the power of stories that go against the grain that aren't otherwise being told. And it's a great piece of literature. So if you haven't read it, you know, you should check it out. I think sadly, in some ways, you know, we've regressed since then. You know, that was a time when Alex Haley could have the most popular show on television and write a really provocative book. And as a reminder of the power, and I would say virtue of the mainstream media, when it's properly focused, you know.
Those were the times. Okay, next quick question, for both of you, actually. So if you could keep just one of the tools that you commonly use in your daily job, what would that tool be?
R.
I like that answer. What about you, Ben?
Oh, the spreadsheet, guys. It all begins with the spreadsheet. You can't play baseball without a bat, and you can't crush data without a spreadsheet. And
You can. R can do everything. There's so many things that R can do that Excel can't.
These R people, they really love R. Have you guys noticed this? Like, I think
I have actually noticed that.
I think not unlike that. There's like R conversion stories. It has an evangelical fervor and flavor, not unlike the Nation of Islam. And so
you're only saying that because you're a Python person. That's the only reason why you're saying that.
I thought you were going to say Python for sure.
No, I think it all comes down to the fundamentals. You know, you can't dribble. You can't play basketball if you can't dribble. You can't play baseball without a bat. I'll give you the religious flavor is I'll pick LibreOffice's Calc, the open source free alternative spreadsheet, which is just as good as the ones from those companies you maybe have heard of.
Okay, if you rephrase the question to what should any journalist be have a tool, I would say Excel. But what should I, as a professional data journalist doing this full-time, crunching numbers like nonstop, then it's R. Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Next one. What is your favorite hack that you are too embarrassed to admit? I can tell you my one is, and I still use occasionally, is the way you can use the find and replace in Microsoft Word as a shortcut to getting stuff done if you're in a hurry. I still use it. I'm slightly embarrassed about it. So there you go. That's mine. Ben, you go first.
Well, I'm not easily embarrassed, which maybe is maybe is a bug, not a feature in my personality. But I mean, a hack, saying no to other people in the newsroom. You know what I mean? I think the data journalists, especially in smaller newsrooms, can sometimes get consumed by helping things just go the way they've always been going, or sort of chipping in around the edges. And I think that being a helper and assisting that is noble work and often really valuable. But I think I see it hold back a lot of other data journalists from really reaching their potential, from taking risks and from doing the more ambitious, powerful work that our skills are capable of. So never be afraid to say no, and never be afraid to bet on yourself and to take a chance.
I guess I don't know if I'd call this a hack, but I am probably most embarrassed to admit that I have data import scripts that I have not automated, but I probably should. And I just still keep running them. It's not exactly by hand, but they're not automated. I feel like I should be moving into the 21st century, but oh well.
Well, I still run out of patience whenever I need to style graphs or charts in R, and I export them as PDFs and I style them in Illustrator just because I find it faster. So that would be my personal hack, and I'm not embarrassed at all in admitting it. So we all have skeletons in our closet, I guess.
I had trouble making a graphic in R yesterday, and I was like, ugh, okay, I'm just going to put it in Excel, and I will make it in Excel.
I do the same thing with Illustrator. It's like, R is not working? Fine. Let me go to the Illustrator's graphing tool, which is sort of like the clunkiest graphing tool ever. So anyway, so let's go to the next one. What would you have done if you hadn't gone into journalism?
OMG, I have no idea. I've wanted to be a journalist since I was 16. No clue.
Well, you know, I was not in a very motivated place before I found journalism, as we covered already, Alberto. But, you know, one thing I did like to do at that time in my young life was read pretentious books and like be like a pretentious, you know, student. And so I think at that time, if you had asked me, I probably would have told you I would have become a high school English teacher or something. You know what I mean? And I don't think that that's a crazy outcome for me. Maybe I would have been happy doing that. It's hard to say. I probably would have stayed in Chicago. And now that I think about it, never met my wife, which is making me sad to even like contemplate. But like, you know, that's probably it.
So glad you didn't do that, Ben.
Oh, my God. My monologue to like high school students about Of Mice and Men, it would be just terrible.
I would pay money to hear that. Okay, last one, pie charts or tree maps? And I'm going to go to Mary Jo for this one.
Tree maps.
Like anything with visualizations, it depends. You know what I mean? Like, so like, I would say like, well, at first I would say never pie charts in the circular form. However, if you have like a single, like categorical thing, I think the like underrated pie chart alternative is a single stacked bar. You know what I mean? Just like one rectangle sliced up. You can do the nice little labels on the top and bottom. And I guess it's technically a stacked bar chart, but it's just a single bar. It's also a pie chart. I think those are great. I think those really work and you can stack them. Doesn't like Pew do that on their quizzes? I think that's good. Because and maybe that is a tree map. I don't know. You guys tell me in some way it is a tree map, I guess. But like to me, the tree map works when there's a lot of slices. Like there's like 50 slices and like one or two of them are huge. You know, and you want to be like, these ones are big and these ones are small. But like, if you only have like five things, you know, you don't need that vertical part of the tree map. If it's just like a fixed wide height, it works fine. Sorry, I just did that. But that's really how I feel about it.
It's a great answer. I mean, tree maps were created to show nested hierarchies, right? So you have a total and then you subdivide that total into large divisions, for example, population of the world. And then you subdivide it into continents, and each one of the continent pieces gets further subdivided into the country. So that's what tree maps are for. So it's an excellent answer. I would advocate for the pie chart, though. So just to be the contrarian, I would vote for pie charts if I could. Simon, can I do that?
You're going to advocate for pie charts?
I did not expect that, Alberto.
I'm getting old, getting older, you know, and a simple pie chart. I tweeted the other day, if a graphic works, it's good. And pie charts, unfortunately or fortunate, often work. It's like if there are two, three subdivisions, four subdivisions perhaps, readers like them, readers understand them, readers read them, they bring attention to the data. So, you know, I'm getting older, more flexible, more pragmatic in some sense. So go for the pie chart.
Even the three-dimensional pie chart?
No, three-dimensional. That's going to... Maybe when I'm 80.
That's a level too far.
Yeah, that's too... No, maybe when I'm about to retire, maybe I will accept 3D pie charts.
Wow. Now that Alberto has been switched with somebody else, I think that's a good point to end. Ben Walsh, Mary Jo Webster, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.